Hey, Kelsey.
Hey, Brooke.
I want to tell everyone what's happening in today's episode.
Brooke, today we're doing Mongolia Part 2. But I want to warn everybody right at the outset. Today we're going to talk about rape and sexual assault. And so if that's a trigger for you, this probably isn't your episode.
Thank you.
Hello, and welcome to Remedial Her Story, The Other 50%, the podcast that explores what happened to the women in history class. Now, here's your host, Kelsey Brooke Eckert, and her partner in crime, Brooke Neva Sullivan.
So, Brooke, today we're talking about Genghis Khan, his expansion across Eurasia, and obviously there's rape and sexual assault involved in that, but we're going to get into that with a little bit more depth, not graphic depth, but we are going to talk about what that really means. And then we're going to look at some of the succession struggles and how his daughters and his sons and gender dynamics were sort of influential in that succession of Genghis Khan. Genghis Khan is notorious for taking over the world. And I think most history teachers, when they talk about him, they tell these stories of the horrifying Mongol, like, horde on horseback coming out of village and the village, like, literally surrendering because they're like, please just don't, like, burn us to the ground, right? And that's accurate. But he did, that was also, like, selective. And so he would, when people were particularly offensive or resisted too long, like, those communities would be destroyed. And so there's one city in modern day Kazakhstan that at the time was, like, one of the biggest cities in the world. And when they sacked that city, they left nothing. Like, it was gone. And that, I think, was used to sort of create psychological warfare on other cities that they encountered. So they were like, oh, please don't let us end up like that city, you know? And so some of it is sort of like myth and some of it is also real. Like, it did happen and we have historical primary evidence about those massacres and whatever. One of the things that horrifies me is around Valentine's Day every year, I see articles about Genghis Khan. And you would think, like, what the hell is the relationship between Valentine's Day and this? And so I want to call out the National Geographic for a second, because they have an article that's titled Genghis Khan, A Prolific Lover, DNA Data Implies. Okay, and they go into an interesting statistic where it's something like 8% of Asian men today are related to Genghis Khan. And what that shows is that obviously he had lots of children and descendants, and not all of them through his primary wife, Borta, right? He has children through his secondary wives, through concubines, and then, of course, probably through rape and assault of women that were, like, brought into a harem and, you know, whatever, as conquered women.
Yeah.
And then, of course, because he has legitimate wives, he also has lots of children through them. And then those children go off and conquer worlds, you know. And so, like, it's right. Like, it makes sense that he would have so many descendants. But to the National Geographic, I'd like to make you rethink, for all the people that are triggered by the trauma of rape and sexual assault, to see a headline of an article about one of the most notorious, like, warlords, essentially, of all time, that refers to him as a prolific lover is a little bit offensive. I would say a lot of bit offensive.
I would just, it's inaccurate.
Inaccurate.
I'm just going to go with no.
No.
Do you think it was trying to be clickbait and thought-provoking, or did they,
absolutely,
were they like, absolutely not, he's not prolific lover?
I mean, for those listening, Google this article. I read the title, Genghis Khan, Prolific Lover. Like,
didn't have a question mark at the end.
No, like, no question of that. They go into, like, how many children he had, how big his empire was, and no conversation really about how one becomes that related to that many people, the process. So it's a little not cool. And I see that's not the only one. There was one from the History Channel. Like it's just heartbreaking to see the callousness with which sexual assault and rape are discussed when it's really far removed from our, like, right? This is so old. This is old history. It's hundreds of years old. And yet it doesn't make it any less traumatizing for the families that lived through that.
Right.
That said, I do think that there is a bit of a representation of just how frequently rape and sexual assault were used as a weapon of war. And what I mean by that was it was used as a weapon of war. And we're having conversations about that right now with relation to modern wars, right? There have been incidents of rape in Ukraine. There have been incidents of rape in Palestine, in Israel. And so, you know, this is not something that's gone away. And the UN is taking, I think, a firm and should be firmer stance on banning that as a use of, as a weapon in wartime. Like, it should be considered a war crime. But in Genghis Khan's time, it was very common. And in medieval warfare, when a city was sacked, they came in and this was just part of it. Part of the reward of being a soldier is you got to pillage. And that meant taking the wealth and the gold and the paintings and all the things off of the walls in the spaces that you've now conquered. But it also meant women and children and enslaved people and all of that as well. So I'm not saying that that's good by any means. However, most of the sources in Western history that we read about the Mongols began with Europeans who were horrified by the Mongol hordes. And so the conversation about him has to be read through the lens of sort of like their racism that would be a little bit blind to their own use of sexual violence in warfare, right? So it was basically like, oh, rape and sexual assault is something Mongols do, and look how horrible they are. And yet, like, that was happening in Germany, and that was happening in, you know, like, this is really common in warfare all over Europe and all over Africa. And so it's not to say, like, because it was common, it was okay. However, I think Genghis Khan has gotten a bit of flack that's a little harsh, given that it was so typical of warfare in that time.
Yeah.
And to his credit, one of the things Khan did was he created space that protected at least Mongol women. And so rape and sexual assault of Mongol women was a crime. It was not obviously okay. And then his daughters and any royal women had special protections. And they, like any man, would have to be tried and convicted of a crime by kind of like a royal assembly that judged them. So in Khan's time, he sets up basically some protections for Mongol women. Rape was definitely used. Sexual assault was definitely common. But it was, I think, arguably not much worse than anywhere else in the world.
Yeah.
Things change when he dies. And so I want to talk about the succession of Khan's empire. And we know, like, over and over and over again in world history, you build a big empire and then it starts to get fragmented. So what Khan did is he was really into symmetry. And so in the territory around sort of modern day Mongolia, all that land was given to his wives as part of like their inheritance and their land to govern and do what they want to do. So he has lots of wives, some of them conquered women. And then there's Borta, who's not a conquered wife. Like, she's been with him from the beginning and is arguably like the reason the Mongol Empire existed, because of her, the raising of her children and the way that she managed all the strategy. So he gives the land to the immediate land around what he's conquered, and pretty secure land to his wives. And then there's sort of this ring outside of that that gets gifted to his daughters. And I think we talked last time about how his daughters are given the title of queen when they get there, and the sons-in-law are given the title of son-in-law and then immediately sent off to war to probably die.
Right.
Outside of that, the sons get land. So when he dies, one of the things that happens is, as typical, when Khan dies, there's succession struggles. Some of the wives also pass away, and so their territories that they were gifted is a little bit up for grabs. And Genghis Khan's sons go a little nutty. And
how so?
They're trying to whip up and grab all this territory that they can to sort of consolidate their power within the empire. We talked a little bit about how Borta's first son there was some legitimacy challenges to him. Thankfully, he died around the same time Genghis Khan did. And so it didn't, even though there was debate, it didn't need to be a problem. The second son was considered kind of a hothead, and Genghis Khan looked past him to be the heir of the empire. And it's actually his third son who inherits the empire. The fourth son happened to be with Khan when he died. And so the fourth son is sort of this regent in that transition time, and then the third son actually gets the power ultimately when he's elected by the council, for lack of a better concept. So these sons sort of do this quick work of conquering land that had belonged to some of the wives. And Ogedai, who inherits the empire, this third son, he does something in this immediate, several years, but in the aftermath. One of the wives of Genghis Khan had died, and her empire was sort of like her territory was sort of needed to be secured. And Ogedai comes in, he takes over these people, and every account of what happens here is probably over exaggerated, but even if it's over exaggerated by like 10 times, what happened was horrible.
Right.
He comes in. He conquers the men, and then he has what some say are 4,000 of the daughters of these people, as young as like 7, 8, 9 years old.
Yep.
He has them repeatedly raped in front of their family members until they either die, or if they survive the ordeal, they're sent off as slaves.
Ugh.
And it's like, even if that's exaggerated by tenfold, even if it was just
one person,
400 women or 40 women, right? Like, it doesn't really matter. That's horrible. So this is obviously a huge departure from the way that Genghis Khan ran his empire.
Yeah.
And most of the historians who write about Khan and write about women in this empire are, first of all, this is a point of conversation, and I don't, you know, this is obviously not something I would bring up in a middle school classroom, but I think it would be something to talk about because I think it builds into the myth about how sexual violence was used within the empire.
Yeah.
And we're actually talking about a son who has probably tons of trauma and PTSD from being at war his entire life.
Right.
And has not had an opportunity to be close to his father and get mentorship and all those sort of things. And most historians look at this as like, and we have turned a leaf here.
Yeah.
That is really, really different. So Ogedai's reign is a big departure from his father. And what we see in the aftermath of Genghis Khan's death is the rise of not his daughters, but his daughters-in-law. And so his daughter-in-law, Torajin, she was Ogedai's wife, and she does a lot of work to basically consolidate power around her son and protect her son and get him in line to the throne and protect his future reign. You could spend in class probably days just going through each of these succession struggles, and I think they're all super fascinating, and the way that the women manipulate power in order to keep power not only in their own hands, arguably, she becomes regent after Ogedai's death to her son, who's not yet of age. So she actually rules the Mongol Empire for like 5 years as Khatun.
Cool.
Yeah, she's so interesting. And if you learned about the Mongol Empire in school, you probably talked about Genghis Khan, and then you like skipped ahead to Kublai Khan, right, who like runs China and interacts with Marco Polo. And so there's a lot of Western sources about that, so people talk about him. But he's a grandson of Khan, and there's all this stuff and all these cool women in between there that I think are really interesting and often get overlooked. And here's a woman who runs the largest empire in world history for like 5 years or something before her son takes over. her story's not super great, and it sort of speaks to the way that women's status in the empire is gradually declining. And I think it's partly that transition from being a pastoral society where women have tons of privileges that their agricultural peers do not. And the more civilized, quote unquote, the Mongols are becoming, the more they adopt agriculture, the more they're settling in cities, the more we're seeing women. And the influence of, you know, Islam and Christianity and Buddhism and all those things on the Mongols are sort of starting to decline women's status. But at the same time, you also have these incredibly powerful Khatuns coming up that I think are really interesting. And so she runs the empire. She actually brings in a political advisor who's a woman, Fatima. Fatima was this political advisor to her. She is so influential that her son actually gets really concerned about the influence this advisor is having on his mother. And so when he becomes Khan, her son basically comes after this financial advisor. He accuses her of being a witch. There's this interesting, a lot of the sources that I've read about the Mongol Empire have this really interesting cultural norm that I don't quite understand, where the Mongols don't like shedding royal blood. And so when they kill a royal or a privileged person, an elite, they do it without shedding blood. And so this woman is brought in front of the court. She's humiliated. She's stripped naked. She is wrapped in a rug and then beaten inside the rug so that there's no bloodshed. And it's like, God, this is horrible, right?
Yikes.
And this also is going against Genghis Khan's sort of idea that you don't, like, without a fair trial and that sort of thing, people shouldn't be killed. And this woman is being killed in a kind of
aggressive
a witch hunt type trial. And then actually she is accused of being a witch and then her body's thrown into a river, that's how she ultimately dies, is drowning. So, that I think is sort of, if Ogadai's treatment of those virgins in his
conquering,
as he's like trying to consolidate power, if that's not illustrative, as Torjin's son assumes the throne, he sort of comes after his mom's advisors and tries to get power behind him. Meanwhile, what's sort of interesting is that fourth son, Tuli, his wife is trying to manipulate the court to show that Ogadai's line is a little bit Looney Tune, and instead you should be putting power in my children over here. And so all of this is to say, I mean, we could go through every one of these stories, and they're all really interesting. We've detailed them in our textbook online, mm-hmm. medialhistory.com/learn, and you can find the chapter on Mongols and the pastoralists. And each one of these queens is just really interesting, and they set their children up. They put power in the hands, like Fatima, of women. And so Fatima, even though she met a really gruesome end, like, she had so much influence for a long time, and it's really interesting. So I think that these queens and these stories are worth getting into with students because they show that, and kings meet gruesome ends too. So it's not like it's just because they were women they met these bad ends.
I know, but we talked about in the last episode a little bit of why we hadn't heard these stories, and a lot of it's starting to come out more and more through the, historians giving access to this information. So it's a really interesting narrative that we have where women are in power for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Well, and interestingly, Jack Weatherford, when he starts his book on women in the Mongol Empire, he actually opens it up with a discussion about the primary source material. And the Secret History of the Mongols was the document that they wrote about themselves, and they ripped out the chapter they ripped out the section. It literally says something to the effect of, to Genghis Khan's daughters, rip.
Whoa.
And so there's nothing,
you don't get it.
You don't get the story there, which is really cool. And so the way we know these stories about the women is because Persians wrote about them, because, Buddhists wrote about them, because there are even European travelers wrote about them. Marco Polo wrote about one of them. And so those sources are giving us insights into these women. all of those sources, though, you have to sort of read
through the lens
through
of
the
it.
Lens.
You're getting it.
Yeah, because they're foreigners. They have their racist perspectives. They're
and it's always like, there's religious. A woman in power? Shock. Awe. Surprise.
Yeah, right. And it makes, you know, it could sort of other those groups. Like, look how uncivilized they are because they have these women.
Yep.
There's a really cool story, and we talk about her in our textbook. Down the line further, there's this woman who doesn't end up getting the throne because even though her father favored her, her brother took power once the father died. But she never marries. And part of it was wrestling is a really big thing in Mongol culture, even today. Their biggest sports are like horseback riding, archery, and wrestling. Those are like the three go-tos.
It's like Roman Empire.
Yeah. And but even today, like I attended when I was there in 2007, I attended like this essentially like a summer Olympic type thing in Ulaanbaatar. And we watched them doing all of these sports and riding horseback and like doing all these cool events. Miss Mongolia was there wearing her, you know, garb, and it was very cute.
Very cool.
But anyway, this woman was an outstanding wrestler, and Marco Polo writes about her. And so suitors would come to like,
and she'd wrestle them,
and she'd be like, okay, like, let's wrestle. Man, and if you can win this, and nobody beat her. And so
Hollywood, I would watch that movie.
Yeah, seriously, right? Like, she's so interesting.
Yeah, no, bring it. I'll arm wrestle you. If you can beat me in an arm wrestle, I'll real wrestle you.
Yeah. I'll real wrestle you.
That's amazing.
But like, literally one suitor came and he was like very confident, like, I got this, like, it's a lady, let's go. And she beats him and he just like leaves in humiliation.
Oh my God, that's classic.
Yeah. So, I mean, the stories of these women are interesting, and they, because they are less constrained by, I don't know, religious society or something, like, they are baller and badass and interesting and like ruling.
I think
huge swaths of
land. I think what you're getting at there too with like there's no rule book. Mm-hmm. Like, they're allowed to make their rules up. Like, there's no one like, this is how society works in your country. And
I mean, it's not to say that there aren't cultural norms in the society.
I'm sure there's a lot in like how they do it, but there's no overarching text to go back to that is the monolith that they have to hold up.
Well, and the text that there is comes from a man who, by all accounts, respected royal women.
Right.
And gave them prestige in society. And there's this like beautiful poem to his first wife, Borta, inside the secret history. And like that is like, if there was a constitutional doctrine or something of like what our culture values, it's women, right?
Yeah. What a difference.
What a difference. So anyway, and the secret history, by the way, like, you can find a PDF of that online and pull excerpts from it. And I mean, even if you didn't want to focus on women in your class, like, I think that would be an exercise that would be really valuable.
Yeah, it's a really interesting culture and a really interesting leader and how they approach it. So yeah, cool.
Yeah. I think, I mean, obviously I'm biased because I went to Mongolia and I think it's so cool, but I just think this history.
There's like this funny thing in my work where it's like, the kid that went abroad once, that's all they talk about.
Yeah, I'm that kid.
You've just become that person. But you've been abroad many a times, but now.
Yeah.
Mongolia episodes. Hey, Kelsey, you've been to Mongolia?
Yeah. It's kind of like a Harvard graduate. Like, you know that they went to Harvard within.
Or someone who does CrossFit.
Yeah.
Cool. Like, got it.
We got it. We know you. Okay.
Oh, did you pack your own lunch? Yeah. No shit. Sorry. Cool.
Yeah. And definitely is that for me. But it's also like,
I like that we've now brought it to our audience. Hey Kelsey, you've been to Mongolia? Yeah. Let me talk about it real quick. It's good.
So next week we are going to have Anne Broadbridge on the podcast to give us a more scholarly talk about this.
Cool.
So I'm excited to interview her and have her. I mean, this is literally, I've been to Mongolia. My research was on the transition from communism to democracy. So it literally had nothing to do with Genghis Khan. So I'm excited to bring you a more scholarly view on some of these things. But I think these first two episodes give everybody a little bit of background that come into that conversation with a little more understanding. So awesome. I'm excited.
Thanks, Kels.
Brooke, thank you.
See you next time.
See you next time.
Thanks so much for listening to Remedial Her Story, The Other 50%. Please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to your podcasts to bring more voices to the conversation. We really appreciate that effort. Until next time.